but I know how to get people to work together, and I'm one of you. I look out for your interests because I'm one of you. Remember that when you vote. Thank you." And he turned and went back to his seat. No applause. The audience was too surprised at the abruptness of his presentation. Wilmot looked startled for a moment, but then he rose and went purposefully to the podium. "Thank you, Mr. Timoshenko," Wilmot said, looking over his shoulder at the engineer. Turning back to the audience, he said, "I think we should give Mr. Timoshenko a hearty round of applause for being so brief, if for no other reason." Wilmot started clapping his meaty hands together, and the crowd quickly joined in. The applause was perfunctory, Eberly thought, and it quickly faded away. "Our final candidate," said Wilmot, "is Dr. Malcolm Eberly, head of the Human Resources Section and chief architect of the proposed constitution that we will vote on come Election Day." Without a further word of introduction, he turned halfway toward Eberly and said very simply, "Dr. Eberly." Several dozen people scattered through the audience got to their feet, applauding loudly, as Eberly rose and stepped to the podium. Others looked around and slowly, almost reluctantly, got up from their seats too and began to clap. By the time Eberly gripped the edges of the podium, half the audience was on their feet, applauding. Sheep, thought Eberly. Most people are nothing better than stupid sheep. Even Wilmot was standing and clapping half-heartedly, too polite to do otherwise. Eberly gestured for silence, and everyone sat down. "I suppose I should say that I'm not a politician either," he began, "or at least I wasn't one until I came into this habitat. But if there is one thing that I've learned during our long months of travel together, it is this. Our society here must not be divided into classes. We must be united, otherwise we will fragment into chaos." He turned slightly to glance at Urbain. Then, looking squarely at his audience again, Eberly said, "Do you want to be divided into scientists and non-scientists? Do you want a small, self-important elite to run your government? What makes these scientists believe that they should be in charge? Why should you have to take orders from an elite group that puts its own goals and its own needs ahead of yours?" The audience stirred. Raising his voice slightly, Eberly said, "Did the scientists help to draft the constitution that you will vote on?" "No. There was not a single scientist on the drafting committee. They were all too busy with their experiments and observations to bother about the way we're going to live." Urbain began to protest. "But we were not asked." Wilmot turned off Urbain's lapel mic. "Rebuttals will come after the first position statements," he said firmly. Urbain's face went red. Suppressing a satisfied grin, Eberly said, "Our new government must be managed by people from every section of our population, not only scientists, not only engineers or technicians. We need the factory laborers and farmers, the office workers and maintenance technicians, butchers and bakers and candlestick makers. Everyone should have a chance to serve in the new government. Everyone should share in the authority and responsibility of power, not just one tiny group of specialists. Everyone." They got to their feet with a roar of approval and applauded like thunder. Eberly smiled at them glowingly. Wilmot stood up and motioned for them to stop. "Your applause is eaten into Dr. Eberly's allotted time," he shouted over their clapping. The applause petered out, and everyone sat down. Eberly lowered his head for a moment, waiting for them to focus their complete attention on him. Then he resumed. "I'll tell you one other thing we need in our new government. A person at its head who understands that we must be united, that we must never allow one elite group to gain power over the rest of us. We need a leader who understands the people, a leader who will work tirelessly for everyone and not merely the scientists." "Damn right," came a voice from the audience. Eberly asked, "Do you want an elite group of specialists to impose their will on you?" "No," several voices answered. Do you want a government that will work for everyone? Yes. Do you want a leader who can control the scientists and work for your benefit? Yes, yes, they shouted, and Eberle saw that his own people were only a small part of those who rose and responded to him. He let them cheer and whistle until Wilmot came to the podium to announce that his initial 5 minutes were up. Eberle went placidly back to his seat, noting with pleasure that Urbane looked upset, almost angry, and Timoshenko's scowl was even darker than usual. Q&A session. Urbane sputtered through the rebuttal period, defending the importance of the habitat's science mission, denying that he would put the scientists' needs above those of all the others. The more he denied, Eberle thought, the more firmly he fixed in the audience's mind the fact that he considered the scientists to be separate and apart, above, really, everyone else. Timoshenko hammered on his theme of being a simple, ordinary working man who understood the needs of the common people. Eberle noted with pleasure that neither candidate attacked him. When it came to his time for a rebuttal statement, Eberle walked slowly to the podium and said, "We have a choice that reminds me of the three bears in the tale of Goldilocks. One of our candidates has too little experience at management. He tells you that he is an ordinary guy. This is quite true. But for the leader of this great society we are struggling to create, we need someone who is not ordinary. We need someone with experience and courage and skill." He hesitated a heartbeat, then said, "The other candidate has too much experience at management. He's been managing scientists for so long that he's completely out of touch with what the rest of us need. Charts and equations and fancy mechanical toys that will explore the surface of Titan have nothing to do with our needs and our future here in this habitat." That brought a round of applause. Eberle stood at the podium, his head bowed slightly, soaking up the adulation. At last, Wilmot got up and said, "Now we'll open the meeting to questions from the floor and from those who are watching these proceedings from their homes." Eberle snapped his attention to the professor. Wilmot hadn't told him that people would be able to call in questions from their homes, and Viborg hadn't even warned him of the possibility. "We don't have anyone ready with prepared questions from home," he thought. "The crowd is seated, but not the home audience."
"You make some sense," Gaeta said to Holly as they sat down again. "I mean, Urbane is dead set against letting me go to Titan, even though Chris has shown him she can clean my suit with nanobugs." Holly nodded and said, "Why don't you ask about that?" Gaeta nodded back at her. "Good idea."
The questions were all for Eberle. The people Viborg had planted in the crowd dominated the Q&A period, and even those who weren't plants addressed their questions to Eberle, not to Urbane or Timoshenko. Eberle stood at the podium, ignoring his opponents sitting a few meters away. Wilmot stood beside him, choosing the questioners from the hands raised in the audience and the incoming calls lighting up his handheld. The questions were all so predictable, Eberle realized with some relief. Even those calling in from their homes asked the kind of routine, boring questions that he could have answered in his sleep. "Yes, I will review all applications for babies. I believe we can allow a modest growth in our population. No, I will not permit any religious group to attain control of the government." He saw Morgenthau's cheek twitch at that answer, but it was the answer they had agreed to give. "We have to get voted into power first," he had told her time and again, "before we can even hint at our true affiliations." "Of course I will pay personal attention to the needs of the farmers," he said to a caller who refused to identify himself. "Without the farms, we will quickly starve." He recognized Manuel Gaeta when the stuntman rose to his feet to ask,
"Will you permit me to go to the surface of Titan?"
Everyone knew Gaeta and his beat-up handsome face. All attention in the outdoor theater turned to him. Eberle couldn't help smiling. "If you can satisfy the scientists that you won't contaminate the life forms on Titan, I don't see any